And welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 642. I'm one of your hosts, Skyler Vicori, and joining me as ever is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going, man?
It's okay, Skyler. I want to officially announce right now that as a person who has rooted for chaos this season, I will stop rooting for chaos, as the reason being that kind of chaos that happened this weekend is not the kind of chaos that Jim wants to see on a racetrack. That is very, very wrong kind of chaos. So I don't want to see any more of that. But all in all, it was some great racing in all the classes, and was looking forward to hopefully some changes for the next race there in Austria.
Yeah, I do too. And that was kind of one of the things I think a lot of people worried about that track, is it can actually produce some rather dangerous things. Like with the, I think Simon had said that during, Simon says, when during the race he had talked about, says anytime you go from a fast section of the track that turns back slowly upon that fast section, it's a recipe for disaster. And when we get to that this week, it'll certainly do it. But first, there's some news, and some very big news indeed, that Dovizioso has left Ducati. But where's he going, Jim?
Nowhere. Is the ballsiest move I think I've seen in a long time. Well, I don't know. Ballsy move being Zarco leaving KTM, but with Dovi, he's decided he's had enough of Ducati. It's a divorce, and the papers have just now been filed. According to Simon Crafar, talking to Dovizioso's manager, they don't have a handshake deal, they don't have a sniff, they don't have an anything to go to. So your guess is as good as mine. I mean, the only factory that's left that he could possibly go to would be Aprilia, because every seat is taken for next year. So either Dovi goes to Aprilia and he takes a severe pay cut to do it, or somehow he talks them into ponying up more cash to meet his demands, or whatever he might be asking for. And you know, I'm not sure what he's thinking, but more power to you. You know, when enough is enough, and I think him and Tardozzi have batted heads is for a long time now. I'll get it out at some point. And
butted heads.
Yeah, and I know him and Gigi Deligna haven't been on speaking terms since about 2018, and. You know, Dovi's kind of upset that he thinks that Deligna has basically resorted to all kinds of sorcery and wizardry with launch devices, the mass dampener in the back of the bike, the aero wings, all that stuff, instead of just getting on with the job of simply fixing what's wrong with the motorcycle. So I see Dovi's point, but man, I mean, he was going to have to take a pay cut to stay at Ducati. I think that's, everybody knows that for sure. So I don't know. I don't understand the thinking and the logic, but who knows?
Yeah, there's probably a lot of stuff that, you know, happened on in the back end that we're not privy to, and the way that his season started probably didn't really help his case too much, being injured and then not really producing any results. And then maybe because he did not, you know, the first offer that might have been there, they may have even walked it down from that, all things considered. But this is a pivotal time for Dovizioso. I mean, it's not like he's going to peak. I mean, he either has or he is right now, and he's going to come down. And like you said, there's not really a lot of factory seats open. And when they do open up, there's a whole, I mean, a big round robin of people who can fill those seats just fine from other teams that are also factory riders or up and coming or the new exciting thing. And you might be kind of on the outside looking in, whether you want to be or not, not just next year, but the year after. And when it comes to sports like, you know, motorcycle racing or anything extreme at the pro level, it's what have you done for me lately? And unless you're carrying a bucket of championships around, you can't necessarily just walk back into the sport a la Jorge Lorenzo or Fernando Alonso in F1. You have to have a resume that allows you to do that. And Dovizioso, while he does have a great resume, I don't know if he has the one where he's going to come in and push anyone out of a factory team that isn't already there. And especially if the guys that are there now, I don't really know whose seat you'd be taking anywhere else. So he definitely does have very limited options when it comes to coming back to MotoGP. I mean, I don't think he would be looking anywhere else to go. I don't think he's like one of the World Superbike guys. I think this is kind of just where he wants to be or not. But it is a ballsy move. We're going to have to see how it plays out.
Yep. Here's a very, very interesting scenario I'll throw out there to you. It is conceivable that Dovizioso wins the World Championship and does not have a ride next year. Think about that for a second. Mm-hmm. It's a very real possibility, especially after what we saw Dovi do this weekend. And we know that there is, you know, there's not really going to be a good racetrack for Quattro and the Yamaha until we get to Misano. And then, you know, we have tracks that are basically suited to the Ducati after that. So stranger things have happened. So who knows?
Yeah, so let's see there. As far as other news, Johann Zarco had to have surgery. He did have a wrist fracture from the crash, something which we will talk about in more depth. Just kind of wanted to cover that there. But other than that, I don't think there was too much else in the news. Except for Honda kind of confirmed Mark Marquez will be sitting out the steering MotoGP round. Kind of knew that. Hafi Sairin is okay. After his nasty crash, we'll get to that as well. But other than that, not too much news going on. I think it's the kind of the theme this year is, because the racing is so limited and it's been so long, everybody's got a big job to get on right now, and you know, contract talks are pretty much sealed up before the season even started. I think Rossi's the only one left, and so when that finally gets announced, we'll get to that. But really, there isn't much to speak about outside of racing, which I'm fine with, because that's all we did talk about for months and months. So, I guess we should just go on and start getting to that good stuff.
Yeah, we can do that. So let's look at Moto3 qualifying from Austria. We had in the first session, we had Sasaki, Alcoba, and Bender, and Anshu were all in that first session. I don't think anybody's surprised by that now. I think we've sort of stabilized as to who's where when it comes to the qualifying and who's in and who's out. But as it turned out, Raul Fernandez took the pole position with a blistering lap that he did take. Arenas was second, McPhee was third, Masia fourth, and Vietti was fifth, and Suzuki took care of the sixth spot on the grid to end up the second row. What's interesting is, given Honda's horsepower, and we kind of saw it at Jerez on the backstretch, and we saw a little bit of it at Brno as well, the horsepower the Hondas were carrying, you think this would have been a natural take for Honda to sweep every spot in qualifying, but they didn't. It was two KTMs, two Hondas, a KTM, three Hondas. So it's definitely, it was a bit of a shakeup. I wasn't expecting that, but a shout out to Dennis Anshu. He actually was 10th on the grid, and he had to come out of that first session. Foggia, I don't think, could get anything going really well. He was in like 11th in there. So that's the basic rundown of qualifying. You want to talk us through the race, Skyler?
Maybe I can make it through the whole race. I mean, this is something, like last week we had a lot of short notes. This week there's a lot of notes to go through. It was actually kind of hard to take notes during this race. There was so much action during the entire race, I didn't really want to look away. But we'll try to do our best here to cover some of it. Arenas got the whole shot. And soon after that, the one name that comes to mind is Bender. Bender really just has to get his Saturdays down so he can be up to the front without having to put so much effort in. He went from 22nd, I think, to 3rd in 6 laps. That is just nuts, especially for Moto3 at a track where it's probably more so, you know, the lighter guys are going to have more of the advantage because of the long straightaways and the power to get up and down the hills. So Bender really had to put on some early moves to get through that. We had McPhee. He hit the front kind of early, earlier than what we've seen for most of his races this year. Yeah. Most of the time we see McPhee, he kind of rolls back and kind of sits in that 5th, 6th to 10th kind of area while he conserves his tires and watches what the guys are going to do, because he knows they're not really going to get away. And then the rise of Dennis Anshu. Now, Anshu, at first, he was getting beat badly in the braking zones. And anytime, he's a very slight guy. He's a young kid, and he's also just has like no weight to him. So that motorcycle doesn't even really know he's on the back when it gets going. So he was a rocket down the straightaways, but he was getting beat pretty bad in the corners. And maybe about 7 laps in, he figured out, oh, I could just brake deeper and his confidence. Like, you actually got to watch his confidence grow as the race was going on, and he started throwing it on the inside of guys, started breaking deeper, and it was like, oh, man, he might be adding to something here. And then we had, unfortunately, Barry Baltus. He ended up crashing in turn three on lap seven. And then Darren Binder made his way to the front. So Darren Binder qualified 22nd, made his way all the way up to the front of the race, and was pretty much going to be up there for the entire time. McPhee, who was up front, I don't know what really happened to him, but he ended up dropping to 13th. I don't think they ever really explained. He might have run wide, and with the way Moto3 was going, it was a train of about 21 bikes the entire race.
Yeah, that was what was amazing, was they said that 2 seconds covered the top 20 bikes. So 1,000, 2,000, you had 20 motorcycles just past you, which is absolutely crazy. But I want to talk just a second for Onchu. Not only did you see him grow in confidence in his braking and everything, that boy was off the track two or three times with elbows out, riding through the grass, which was the beginning of the chaos, because I think everybody decided they had to top whatever happened in Moto 3. But it was a great ride from the kid. I think it might have been like one of those things where the light switch kind of flipped, maybe, and he now realizes that he can run at the front, he can battle with those guys, he's got the skill set, he has the talent, he has the equipment, and I think it kind of just all turned in. I'm really looking forward to the next weekend to see if he kind of continues on the path that he was on. He's still got a lot to learn as far as the racecraft that's going to be considered, as far as when to draft, when not to draft, and who to draft, and that kind of a thing. But he was looking really the best that we had seen, because, you know, we know his brother was good, you know, having won in the rain in Valencia on his debut, and then his brother kind of tapered off, where sort of Denis has kind of been the other way around. He started really slow, and he's sort of ramping it up as the season goes on.
Now, they're all part of him and his brother. They're mentored by Kenan Sofwoglu, correct?
Yes. Kenan takes care of him.
And it kind of makes sense. So Kenyon, for those of you that never really watched World Supersport, he was an elbows out, no holds bar rider. I mean, he would throw it anywhere. Any gap you leave him, he was going for it. No matter where it was, he pulled a lot of the same moves you saw Onchu, where it's like, oh, look, there's a small gap. Okay, I might run in the grass, but then the road's going to come back to me, so I'll just ride across it and keep on going. He pulled a lot of that kind of stuff, backing it in. And that's where he kind of made his name, and that's why he was so hard to beat, because he raced so hard. He raced fair, but he raced like a guy who was pissed the whole time. And you kind of see that from Onchu, where he didn't take anybody's crap. He didn't make any sketchy moves. He didn't use anybody as a berm, but he took advantage of every little thing that you would mess up. He'd come flying past you. He was not afraid of being squeezed out to the track. He would run everybody to the edge of the track. You wouldn't get by him. But if you just let the smallest, if two wheels, not the fenders, if two wheels could stay on the track, he was going to make his way through. I think they had the camera on Arenas, or maybe it was what's his name on the KTM bike. Raul Fernandez, I think they had the camera on his bike, and Onchu, like, they're just falling in the back, and Onchu just appears out of nowhere, and he's, like, paced along the side of his bike as he goes by him. I mean, it was nuts.
Yeah. It's a shame that he kind of fell off there at the end, but again, that's the racecraft that he has to learn, that he doesn't know yet. And once he gets that piece of the puzzle figured out, kid should be pretty damn good.
Yeah, and this was a race where you really did have to have your racecraft, because there was never that, like, 10 rider breakaway.
No.
Where these guys can get there and settle. It was constantly you were either drafting, getting drafted, getting passed, and it wouldn't just lose like one spot either. Like, if you got drafted or double drafted, you were losing three or four. You had to go back into play, you had to come back around. It was almost like when you're cycling and you're in a draft line and you kind of fall off to the back, and eventually you get to make your way through drafting to the front again. It was very much like that, and it just kept going and going. And I kept thinking to myself, I was like, dude, is this ever going to stop? Are we going to have a moment? And I have in my notes, there's a good section of time where I just didn't even take any notes, because I was watching, like, I don't even know what to take notes on, other than to say, elbows are out, here we go, there's 10 laps left, I don't know who's going to win this thing. I mean, Anshu's telling me, Sasaki came into the front, and then Viette, he decided he wanted to play around, so he got his elbows out real sharp, started banging around. Juan Macia came to the front, we're thinking, okay, the Leopold team, they've got their bike up there, and it's very fast in a straight line, okay, he's probably going to win it, and we had already forgotten Albert Arenas, and then Albert Arenas, all of a sudden, he's like, you know what, you guys forgot about me, I'm here to play. Bender's like, I've been up here. I'm still ready to play. And then in the final couple of laps, this is where the racecraft definitely came into play, like you mentioned, because where we did see Anshu up towards the front for a majority of the race, about 75% of it, if not more, he kind of got pushed around a little bit, and guys were right behind him taking advantage. He filtered back, I think, around maybe even as low as about 13th place at some point with about three laps to go. And Arenas, who had track warnings and had to play it very safe, all of a sudden he looked in contention. But when he got up to the front there, he started to get in a little elbows, I think, with Sasaki and a few others. And Drama Sia started pulling away, and he ended up getting about, I don't know, it almost looked like just under a second gap. And I was thinking to myself at this point, Jim, I was like, it's over. It's over. There's no way they're going to catch him.
That's what I thought, too. I thought he had the break. Oddity of all oddity, everybody decided to go absolutely helter-skelter behind him, and zoom, off he went. But then there's three long straightaways in Austria. So basically, everybody in the pack got smart, started to ride together, and literally went and caught him again. So it just, the pack for that second, for three quarters of a lap, Masia was gone. But then the pack just sucked him right back in again. And there you were, waiting for the race to finish off. And you really didn't know who was going to win. I mean, Masia had a shot at it. Arenas had a shot at it. McPhee definitely had a shot at it. And then, you know, the people that, you know, it was kind of those three were definitely the guys that were going to stay towards the front. And you knew those were kind of who were going to be there. Although, Ayagura shows up, like, super late to the party. He showed up with, like, three laps to go and went like, oh, exactly. By the way, I'm here, people. Like, oh, man, I didn't even see that coming because I'm watching the front and you're not really – the only way you could watch where Ayagura was to see him kind of just go up the leaderboard on the side of the screen and all of a sudden, poof, he's there at the end. And I'm like, oh, crap, Ayagura could win this one. So, again, you're just – it's – I don't know what to watch. I don't know who to watch. All I know is that the racing is really good and we're down to three laps to go with basically five guys can win this.
Yeah, we get that, like, that last little – like the double chicane to the 6-7 – 8 complex, and as they come up the hill, like, Arenas just had this super drive. I don't know if Masai just didn't get it together or pull it up, but Arenas just ripped it past him. He ended up bringing up Ayagura as well, and they came up, both kind of slid past there, and they ended up going sliding around, and that's when you finally saw the checker flag come out, and dude, Arenas had just put in like the ultimate last lap to get there. He beats Drama Sia to the line, and we kind of thought Ayagura got third, and this is where the penalties started. Oh, so many penalties, Jim.
So, yes, there are many penalties. Many penalties. But first, I'd like to give the shout-out to Arenas, because early on, he did have track limits warning. So he rode a clean race for three-quarters of the distance. I didn't think he could do it, especially with Turn 10, how that is, where they you know, if you ever watched the Formula 1 cars – Formula 1 cars race there, you know that the Formula 1 cars are about a good 3 or 4 meters farther over to the edge of the track. So they actually change that angle, that corner a little bit, and they paint it off, and you have essentially a faux curb, if you will. That's the red and white checkered area, and then a green area. Well, you can't go over the onto that green, and these guys were riding millimeter perfect for all that. But what exactly was the penalty that Ayagura actually was given?
So he lost one place because he extended track limits. Basically, you had to stay on the curb. As soon as you hit the green, boom, that was the penalty. And because it was the last lap, they can't dish out any time subtractions. They can't tell you to drop a place or anything like that. So they just drop you a place automatically. So I was like, oh, okay. So he lost his place. And it's like, well, so did who was right there with him?
Vietti was there in the mix.
Vietti was there. Oh, Bender. That's the only thing. I was like, Darren Bender was there. Now, Darren Bender was riding right there. He slid over the line. He was right in front of, I think, Ayagura. And then Vietti was right behind them. So they get there, and then all of a sudden they said, oh, okay. Well, Bender ran wide, and so did Ayagura. So he lost place. Vietti, you got third. So they wheel his bike into the into Parc Fermé, and he's got his helmet off, and he was literally being pointed over to go do interview with the mic, and then the Dorna guy who's down there all the time grabs his shoulder, says, wait a second, and they were sitting around, and then which really was a weird thing that they made the decision on Bender and Ayagura from the video so soon. But if you were watching the same video as everybody else in the world, you saw Viette was on the exact same line at the exact same time. So I don't really know why they even thought Viette was not guilty of this and that they didn't get that corrected any sooner. I mean, I was in my notes like, how is it Viette is going to be given this position? Yet he did the exact same thing. And then they ended up pulling Viette back out and tell John McPhee, oh, you've got to come up here now. So John McPhee crossed the line in sixth, but winds up third in the race. And somehow, I'm just kind of looking at the results here. I see Ayagura slid back a spot, but Darren Bender went all the way back to sixth. And that just, that doesn't seem right.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there at that one. But, I mean, you know, it is, you know, if you we look at MotoGP and we look at the race, you know, the actual standings is Arenas, then Masia, McPhee, Agura, Vietti, Bender, Arbolino, Anshu, Fernandez, and Suzuki is your top 10. I mean, that's the official standings. So it definitely is one of those ones where I don't think we actually kind of sat around long enough to figure out all the permutations of what happened and who was the first infractor, and then who was the second infractor of all this. And it gives it, do you have an abacus in an hour and we'll flip a variable and do derivatives and come up with something? But let's just,
PTSD from math class here. Let's not start that.
Oh yeah. It was like, okay, now you're taking the fun out of the racing. If we're going to sit here and do math at the end of it to figure out who actually wins. But
yeah,
it's, I don't know. I mean, I applaud MotoGP for trying to very quickly at least determine the podium so that at least the people, well, there's not any people there, but at least people who are watching kind of casually would have saw, hey, these are the three guys on the podium, and then they would at least know that's who won. Instead of, you know, we've seen Formula One take hours after a race to deliberate as to whether or not somebody should or shouldn't be on the podium. And like, you know, guys, you got to kind of just go with it here at some point, so... I'll give him props for that, but yeah, there needs to be a little bit better explanation for why everybody is kind of where they are.
Yeah, and you know, this is one of those things where I understand you got to follow a rule, right?
Was it that Bender had a warning for track limits, so that they penalized him sort of twice? Because
it could very well be
because I don't think like anybody else like Agura only ever did it on the last lap. I don't remember him having a track warning. So maybe it's like you ran a foul twice or something.
He's got to drop two places kind of thing, which would make sense.
Okay. Yeah, I think that maybe that's where it is. But, yeah. You know.
So my takeaway from it all is, yes, there's rules. But it's definitely a harsh rule to have to be able to enforce on the last lap, because the entire point of the rule of track limits and why they have them there is you're getting an advantage, right? Right. And if all three guys who are racing for the exact same position and all three do it, did anybody really gain an advantage? And it's kind of like, it's the last lap. I mean, was it really egregious? No. I mean, you're pushing. You're getting there. But I mean, it's a tough call. I mean, if you follow the rules exactly, at least then you can be consistent. So maybe that's why they do it that way, right? It's like, well, you broke the rule. Sorry, that's it. But definitely tough. And I definitely, you know, feel for the guys that were up there. And Darren Bender, I will say this, he needs to get out of Moto3 and needs to get on a bigger bike. He is only limited by his size at this point. The reason why I think he crashes so much is because he has to push so hard into the corners and make all the time up on braking, because he loses it all in the straightaways because he's one of the bigger dudes. He can't tuck it all in. I don't think weight's a huge factor. I don't think Darren Bender's a very big guy. I think he might be a little bit bigger than his brother, but I mean, that's really not saying much. I mean, Brad's not a big dude either. Anybody that can tuck into a Moto3 bike is not a very big guy. But his style and his unruly, like, he will ride the hell out of anything. He is going to tame the bull, and you can see that he rides just like his brother, so I'm pretty sure they've been banging bars for a long time. That's why they ride like they do. But I feel like he's going to thrive in Moto2, and Moto3 is just like, all right, dude, just dust yourself off and let's get going on something that's more so for your style.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting if Jorge Martin really does have a Pramac Ducati ride. be really interesting to see Darren Bender on the IO KTM.
That would be interesting. I would like to see that, and maybe, you know, brother back and do a little elbow greasing for him, and kind of like, hey, you know, I got this brothers pretty good down there, and you guys like to bring up the talent.
Yeah, I mean, I think Darren is pretty talented.
He very much is,
right? I mean, he may not be star quality like his brother. He may not be star quality like Quartararo or Marquez, but I definitely think he's a solid guy. I think he's one of those guys where if he could ride on a bigger bike, he would be able to showcase his talent a little better because the bike will suit his size.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, I'm all for it. I'm all for Darren having a Moto 2 ride.
Yeah. And so that brings us down to the championship. So Albert Reynos is taking a nice hefty lead of the championship. Not as much as he wanted, because if John McPhee had crossed the line at 6, he would have got a bigger gap, but that's all right. He'll take the weekend after the wicked crash and toughing it out last time. He's leading the championship on 95 points in front of John McPhee on 67. Ayagura is in third position on 65. Tatsuki Suzuki is there, sitting there on 50 points. Raul Fernandez on 43. Celestino Viette, he's there in 6th. Tony Arbolino in 7th. Juan Macia in 8th. Gabriel Rodrigo in 9th. And Dennis Foggia in 10th. The championship is really close there for the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and then kind of a little bit back there, the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, kind of right around there. Those are all really tight in points. So even though we have not a whole lot of races to go this year because of the shortened season, it's still, I mean, you can't have an off weekend. You definitely got to keep it going.
No, I think Reynos is the favorite right now. I don't think anybody is going to beat him. Stranger things have happened. But one of the things is that Reynos has been consistent as hell, and that's the most important thing. And he's played hurt and still did very, very well. And, you know, he was still hurt and he still won the race. And that's what a champion does. So, you know, he is deserving of the title. I mean, on the small sample size of races, I think we're, what, at 6 rounds for Moto 2 or for Moto 3. So it's good, but, you know, the other guy's got to step their game up because Arenas' game has definitely been upped. So if anybody wants to chase him down for the title, they need to start winning races and being at the front consistently or have better consistency than what Arenas has right now.
Yeah, Arenas, I'm pretty sure he's on his way to Moto 2 after this year. Whether or not he wins a championship, his racecraft has stepped it up. He's kind of got everything put together now. He can break deep. He can sit back, conserve tires. He can run ultimate fast laps when he needs to. He can ride when he's hurt. He can ride when the bike is not great. When you've got all that down, I mean, your head is perfect for racing. You'll win championships that way. And he kind of reminds me of when Joan Mir a few years ago was in Moto 3, and he would always be towards the front, but he never really had to lead at all. He just knew exactly when to pull the pin to get the win.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. Kind of definitely in that same vein. So look forward to seeing what happens next weekend with these guys because, they got to top the craziness, I guess.
Yeah, they got to run it back. So that brings us to Moto 2 qualifying, which, of course, I didn't watch. But Jim is going to take us through it.
So in the first round of qualifying was Marcel Schroeter, Joe Roberts, Baldessari, and Manzi, which... you kind of got to go, that's sort of where it should be. You kind of hope that maybe Roberts would have been in the fast 14 or whatever that is that you need to be in the first session. But it looks like they were kind of struggling a little bit with the setup. They couldn't quite get it there. But when we went into this qualifying session, Jorge Martin went out initially, and he just threw down a lap that was really pretty damn good. You know, it was at beginning of the session, you always seem to see the fast laps in the beginning of the sessions, as we've seen so far this year. The first 3 to 5 laps is where the pole position time kind of comes from. And I thought that Martin had it. He had come back in, he was in the garage, and lo and behold, there was this kid named Remy Gardner who was out there running around, still putting down hot laps. And he was able to actually put down a lap time that put him on pole. And it was like Martin kind of jumps up like, okay, well, we're going now. We're going to go do a second run. And then Martin took the pole back, but then Gardner was able to come through and snagged the pole again. He only did it by 36 hundredths of a second over Martin, which this is, again, Martin has been qualifying on the front row here consistently. Schroeder came out of that first session to be third quickest. Bashini was heading up the second row. Aaron Canet on the speed up looked really good in qualifying. He was the first non-Kalex bike in fourth. So that seemed to be encouraging for Canet. You think maybe he's starting to come to grips with the Dunlop tires, the new profile front tire that they have, and with just the Triumph engine in itself. Lowe's had a difficult qualifying session. He was in sixth. Then you had Navara, Marini, and Thomas Luthi finishing out the top three rows. So we move into the race, unless you have something you want to add about qualifying. There,
I'm good.
Good, all right. So we get into the race. Martin takes off like a bullet shot out of a cannon. Gardner was there in third, and Schroeder was right there with him. And this kind of is the pattern of where we were. Those guys out front, Bashini was like fourth or fifth. He wound up getting pushed back a couple of places by about, what was that, the fourth or fifth lap. And then, you know, I was thinking, okay, wow, this is going to settle in and just be a fairly straightforward and boring race, because Martin was out front. He was pulling away by a few tenths a lap. He really didn't look like he was struggling at all to perform the times that he was doing. And suddenly, we go through turn one. Bashini goes over that rise and that crest, and he loses the back end because the suspension unloads. It high sides him over one way, catches it, comes back, goes the other way. He can't save it this time. Boom. Down goes Bashini. And the bike and him slide down the track. Now, Bashini is quickly up to his feet. He gets himself off to the edge of the track, as you would, because he knows there's bikes coming. But the problem was that the bike is over the crest of the hill, so you kind of don't know where it is. And you can see the other guys are all making adjustments very quickly to be able to dart out of the way of that motorcycle. And I'm holding my breath because I kind of know what's going to happen. Somebody's going to be unsighted as they come over that hill, because they're going to be in a draft or looking for that draft. And that person was poor old Hafe Siren, who basically flat chat went into the downed motorcycle of Bashini, and it just flicked him off like a toothpick and flung him down the track. And I mean flung him in the most literal sense of the word, as he was at least a good 150 feet away from the impact scene where his body finally stopped sliding. It ripped the front off of Hoffy's bike. It destroyed Bastianini's bike as well, and we wound up with the red flag to sort of sort out all of the chaos that had ensued up to that point. So I don't know what you thought of it, Skyler, but it was a scary moment. I was glad Hoffy was down for a good long time with the medical people, and I was holding my breath because I really thought Hoffy was at least beat up really pretty bad.
Yeah, I was very concerned, because especially when they were doing the replays, they would not show the point of impact for a long time. They just kind of showed the bike going down, and then they would cut away. So it made me think the stuff that we didn't see on camera was much, much worse, like he got hit by another bike or anything like that going down the track. And while it was still bad, if him hitting the injector seat and getting launched, it wasn't as bad as what I had thought when he hit the ground and rolled. He did move a lot, because he was probably like, oh, everything hurts. Oh, shit, everything hurts. But he was conscious the whole time, which is thankful he didn't, like, whack his head really hard on the ground or anything like that. But like you said, they worked on him a long time, rolled the ambulances directly onto the track. They didn't want to even put him on the stretcher and take him off to the side. The track cleanup was going to take some time anyway, because there was oil and debris everywhere on that track. But this is the one that we've talked about it several times. We saw it last time at Brno, where the bike goes down in the middle of the track, and you're just like, oh, please miss it, please miss it. And they do, and you're like, whew, okay, cool. But this was not one of those cases, and this is a very real thing, is that they come over that corner, and the thing is, too, that is a, you know, power straightaway. So they're on it, and he was tucked up, and he busts up the trap and hits that thing. I mean, he's lucky to get away with it. I mean, they took him to medical center, no broken bones, just a bunch of bruises and soreness. That's it. That's all he had.
Yeah, that's a testament in all reality to the advances that have been made in helmet technology, the leathers that the riders wear with the airbags, it's sensed that there's been an impact, that there's been an acceleration that dictates as a crash, and the airbag blows out and, you know, puffs you up and makes you look like the Michelin man for a few seconds. And that has to, you know, that's just great for Hoffy to be able to just be banged, bruised, contused, and dazed, and, you know, maybe need a new pair of underwear. But all of this is a result of the track layout in Austria. You know, here you've got a climbing, rising turn that the bikes go up over, and they crest it right when they just start to get on the gas at maximum acceleration. So, you know, we're dealing with the issue of physics here, right? If I'm coming out of the corner and I gas it up hard, the weight transfer is going to go from the front of the bike to the back of the bike, right? So now you've taken that rear spring, you've compressed it, you've built up energy in it. Well, as you go over the crest, now you have an inertial force, you know, centripetal force is going over the top that now wants to help unload that spring, because now they're you know, gravity is not taking as much effect pushing the bike down. You have all that pent up energy in the spring that needs to be released, which usually happens gradually along the straightaway, suddenly goes off real quick, and that's where Bastianini lost it. I mean, as a club racer, we used to go to Groton, Michigan and race, and they had this great turn. It was, if you ran the track clockwise, it was the third turn, and it was literally over a little crest and down the hill to the bottom, and it was and you go back up, and it was in a really short amount of time. Maybe it was maybe 20 feet and maybe about 40 or 50 feet of racetrack. Well, every year we'd go there and we'd run Wira, we would at least run that track backwards twice. So you're trying to go up that hill, and so many guys would go there and would eject themselves over the high side just simply based on the fact that you're going uphill over a crest, and now the bike unloads when you're on it. The tire loses grip and suddenly regrips, and off to the high side you go. I mean, I think they finally stopped running backwards because of that, but I'm not 100% on that one. But that's what you're dealing with, and that's one of the reasons I don't really care for the track in Austria. Is it's a fast track, and it's not that technical, honestly. There's not really a set of chicanes or a hard set of corners that you got to figure out a great line through it, or you know, it's not like, I'm trying to think, it's not like Jerez where you got to string a corner together to another corner and you've got to be precise with what you're doing. You have some freedom to run some different lines, but that track is incredibly technical because of the speed at which you're going, because you're going so fast. And now the optimum line has now been reduced. If you used to have maybe a foot at, say, Jerez on a circuit that's slower, now you're at a circuit that's so much faster that now you don't have that foot of space to work with. You've got 6 inches to work with. So it's an incredibly technical challenge, and, you know, that's just the nature of the beast that we have here. And we saw what is possible. But, you know, thank God everybody was okay from that.
Absolutely. And so that got us down. We had to red flag the race, get a restart. We had Martin jump out. He got us another great start, get out to the front, started pulling away. Navarro went down at turn 10, and so did his championship. He has not had a great season. I think he's crashed 3 out of 4, or the last 3 out of 4, something like that. Definitely not looking good, and his confidence is probably taking a hit as well. Tom Luthi was looking like his own self, getting back up there and kind of mixed it up with the top 10. And then the riders started running wide, left and right. They were pushing hard. Marco Bezzecchi being definitely one of the ones that was pushing hard. He's having a great sophomore year. You're really seeing that he's kind of come to grips with the bike, and he's making a real good push towards the front. And then Nagashimi, he crashes on the restart of lap 4 on turn 1. And his championship is pretty much gone. The winner of the opening round, who we thought was like, man, this guy kind of came out of nowhere. The IO team, you know, the KTM team, they really know how to find these guys. And he's really never returned to that form. The rest of the year's been running mid-pack or worse, and just really hasn't been himself. So I wonder kind of what's going on there. And then unfortunately, we lost our pole setter, Remy Gardner. He went down in turn 1. He lost the front end as well. A lot of guys were losing their front end there, pushing real hard off the straightaway, trying to make up some time and make sure they carried as much speed as possible there onto the second straightaway. And Xavi Virhe, for as much stick as we were giving him over the last couple of shows, man, he was an exciting racer to watch this week. He was definitely a lot stronger. He was backing it in everywhere. He was wild, man, kind of what we're used to seeing with him. And then him and Sam Lowes had a very close call on the track towards the end there. But really, the man in the hour was Jorge Martin. He won the race in dominant fashion, especially if dominant fashion that it comes to Moto 2. He just kind of sat out front, did exactly what he needed to do, was never really bothered by anybody else, and pulled off a great win. And the guy that we saw in Moto 3 just a short time ago has really found his groove in Moto 2.
Yep. I was surprised that it took Martin this long to actually win a Moto2 race. Mm-hmm. But I think it needs to be chassis corrected, if you will, because we know that that KTM chassis last year sucked. You know, and Binder made that, Binder flattered that bike to the point that he almost won the championship on it. So for Martin being a rookie in the class that year on a bike that they were chasing setups and throwing frames at him was probably a bit too much for the poor guy to try to work through. Way too many variables there, but he was running near the front. He just, you thought he would win a race here or there, but he just didn't seem to be able to accomplish it. And I think a lot of it was just, I think those the KTM frames kind of used the tires up, or at least used them a whole lot more than what Martin was used to. So he was running on a pretty rag tire there towards the end of each of those races, where Binder just simply accepted it and was able to perform on a worn tire. But now that we've had some races and he's been on this Kalex chassis, he's been able to sort through it. It's a learning curve for the IO guys as well, right? Because they're learning a Kalex where they had KTM chassis before, but they've been able to now get something that seems like it might work for him, because this is his best qualifying that he's had. He definitely looked very confident on the motorcycle now. I think he's got it to where it does what he wants it to do, or at the very least, they found a very good base setup that they're now working from, and they're just making the small minor adjustments, and they're able to focus more on what were we going to do for the race, what tire do we want, what tire do we want on the front. Those kind of decisions now are more what they're doing as opposed to trying to find a setup to begin with. And it showed, and Martin has showed his talent. The guy's a Moto3 champion for a reason, and he is out front in Moto2 now, and he's looking pretty darn good on that motorcycle.
Absolutely. So that brings us to the race results. Jorge Martin in first, Marshall Schroeder in second place. Nice recovery ride for him. Luca Marini finishing in a nice strong third position in front of Marco Bezzecchi, who had a nice almost podium there. He's another one of those riders we had mentioned. He kind of came in the same time as Martini. I think it was Martini's protagonist there in his final year of Moto3. He's stepping it up big time. Anea Bastianini. Oops, we're reading the wrong ones here. Because did Anea Bastianini restart, or am I crazy here, Jim?
Let me look here real quick. If we look at the
because
race
results, it has Remy Gardner in here too. So this is
this is from the first race. It's the you gotta have the second race for it. So it's actually Martin who wins, then Marini, then Schroeder, Lowe's was fourth, Virahe's fifth, then it's Marco Bezzecchi, Luthi, Fernandez, Canet with a decent ride to ninth, and then Joe Roberts finishes in tenth. So that's there we go. My mistake there in the old El Notos, I forgot that they were divided into two races as opposed to one. So I did you dirty there, pal. Sorry.
No worries. That's what I was reading. As I was like reading ahead, I was like, no. Mouth was still going. I was like, no. I was like, other than the brain and the mouth caught up. I'm like, no, that's not right. Okay.
That brings us to our chat. Notes, okay? Come on, people. Give me a break.
We do this for free. Leave us alone. So... That brings us to our championship. Luca Marini leading the championship here on 78 points. Now, Anea Bastianini in second on 73. Very tight at the top there between those two. Definitely been some of the strongest riders this year, so I'm pretty sure this one's going to take the whole season to dive out. Jorge Martin has now brought himself up into a tie for third place, but he finished just ahead of Sam Lowes, who is now in fourth place. Tetsuka Nagashima slips back to fifth place on 55 points in the championship. Aaron Canet is in sixth place, not bad for the rookie. Marco Bezzecchi there in seventh. Chavi Voorhees in eighth. Joe Roberts now in ninth in the championship. And Lorenzo Baldessari, the name that we said has been having a horrible season. I guess it's you've done really good things with the rest of time in Moto2, but horrible seasons and you're 10th. And the Moto2 World Championship. Now, you're not going to win it on 33 points back from on 78, but hey, still, top 10. I mean, for a guy that's having a terrible season, it's just, he's having a lost season. I guess we should just put it that way.
Yep. I definitely think this is the best championship going in this series, and I think this one is going to take all the races to figure out who is actually going to be the champion. I just think the pendulum here has swung so differently at most of these races that this one is really the one to watch. Now, the races themselves might be boring because somebody runs all the way out front, but the championship race is very tight, and it's definitely the one to watch, at least for right now.
Absolutely. And that brings us into MotoGP qualifying, which I did watch, so do a little reverse course. I'll do a little bit of qualifying, and Jim will do a little bit of racing, and we'll be good. So something I noticed that Aprilia was saying, they had the fourth fastest bike in the speed traps during the weekend prior to qualifying, which is going to show you they've got the engine, and they said they made a big step with the chassis, but when they have it turned up, it's really good. But apparently there's still, you know, reliability issues, they're still working out, but they're getting closer and they're on the way. We may see them make a big push here in the next year or two, much like KTM did as well. Petrucci, during Q1, you kind of saw Petrucci and Aleix Espargaró, they end up having words. I'm not real sure what Petrucci's issue was. Maybe he's just mad at Aleix. He's like, maybe he's telling him, like, man, my bike really sucks right now. I can't get it to do anything. I don't know what he was mad about, but move on. And then right at the end, Rossi, man, he sent it to get into Q2. He had to put a lap in, just kind of came out of nowhere, because at this point we thought it was nothing but Ducatis and Yamahas, and that was kind of the surprising theme that we were going to run through here in qualifying, is that as much as we thought this was going to be nothing but a Ducati and KTM track, they weren't really putting up much of the competition in qualifying, which is weird. But when it came down to Q1, Rossi and Zarco ended up going through. Binder just didn't seem to come to grips quite with the track yet. After we saw such the miraculous win last time out at Brno, he just wasn't quite there. We thought it was going to suit him much more, but not necessarily the track for Binder. And that brought us into Q2. And right from the outset, you're thinking, like, man, Yamaha must have figured something out in qualifying, because they were going fast. Not just Vinales, but Quartararo, Morbidelli, everybody was going fast. Rossi too. And Vinales was looking really, really good. He was out there. He had set a fast lap from pretty much the drop of qualifying, which is not necessarily his thing. It takes him a little while to get going. And the fastest lap was being swapped around left and right. And the front row just kept changing. And it was really, really tight times. But in the end, when it came down to the qualifying, you had Matt Vinales on pole in front of Jack Miller, pretty much, who ended up pulling up the, I think he threw off some weight on the back of the Ducati and finally got the Ducati where it should be. Fabio Quartararo on third. Andrea Dovizioso, right before qualifying, is when they kind of came onto the TV with Simon Crafar there. Andrea Dovizioso's manager said, yeah, no, we're not going back to Ducati. That's it. The deal. We're not going anywhere. Thanks for coming. It's like, whoa. And that was a big mic drop moment right before qualifying. And then Dovizioso goes up and has one of his better qualifyings of the year, finished fourth. Pol Espargaró in fifth. He did have a higher time, but I think his time was deleted, so he's a little upset with that.
He had a track. He exceeded track limits there in turn 10. So yeah, that ixnayed his best lap.
And it was going to be the first of many frustrations for Pol, unfortunately, during this weekend. And then Juan Mir there in sixth, another standout ride for him on the Suzuki. There's going to be a foreshadowing for things to come. Franco Morbidelli there in seventh. Alex Rins in eighth. Johann Zarco ninth. Taka Nakagami there in 10th. Miguel Oliveira and Valentino Rossi, for all of his efforts to get out, finished in 12th. But if you look at the times, it was a 1:23.4 for Pol, and in 12th place at Rossi, it was a 1:23.9. Damn, that's tight.
That's 56 hundredths of a second separating the top 12 motorcycles on a MotoGP grid. If you're wanting parity, you have now found parity.
That's
that
right.
That's just how that goes.
At a horsepower track, mind you.
Yes, it is. But we will soon learn that there's a reason why the Yamahas are actually fast in qualifying, but things are a little different come race day, that's for sure.
That's right.
So let's get into the race, because this is so many talking points. But as the race takes off, you basically got Miller get definitely want to talk about this. This is before the race. If you guys have the Dorna feed for MotoGP and you watch it online, you need to watch. Did you see Jack Miller actually engage and use the hole shot device when he pulled up on his bike? It was a great camera angle. It's the camera that points back from underneath the fairing and looks straight at Jack. He comes in after the warm-up lap, comes to his grid position. He flicks a button on with his left thumb on the handlebar, then reaches up and turns a knob or something on the dash up by where the camera was, and you can literally watch the back of the motorcycle fall about 2 inches. And since last week we had this great discussion about how the devices actually work. Thanks to Michael for writing in. You were able to actually witness that. Now, I would love to see that same shot with Quartararo to see the difference between the Yamaha. But if you have the chance to go back and see that part of the race again, do. Because it is really interesting to watch Miller's bike just drop down. So at the green, that gave Miller the opportunity to grab a hole shot. He was right there. You had Quartararo was with him at the beginning as well. But the big, and Dovizioso was also there, and Espargaro was there too. So definitely the people we expected to be at the front or at the front. We're just trying to figure out where everybody's going to be. Well, Quartararo kind of had, he had the mistake at about lap three where he ran off the track at turn four. At the end of turn four. There's kinks that aren't counted, and there's kinks that are counted at Austria. You can't keep it straight. So anyway, Quartararo goes off there. But he had that little bit of an incident with Espargaro because they kind of had that come together on the straightaway there. I don't know about you, Skyler, but I think the head shake on the Yamaha caused the pucks and the front calipers to back off. And I think that when Quartararo went for the brakes, there was nothing, and he was doing the pump, 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 pump thing to get him to come back up. Although we did learn later on that Quartararo was suffering from heated brakes. The brakes got really hot, so they weren't stopping very well. Again, that's a problem with a carbon brake. They're designed to work at very high temperatures, but not ultra high temperatures, and so that might have been part of the issue as well. But Espargaro, having dispatched with Quartararo, kind of got on a charge there, and he had race pace most of the weekend, especially in FP4 and the warm-up. He had the best race pace of anybody. He was looking strong. He had then ran down Miller. He had gotten Miller. He'd gotten Vinales, who now Vinales was kind of working his way backwards. So it was kind of a pull, and it was and Miller, and they were at the front, and you kind of had the Yamahas were in there, and then the chaos ensues. Zarco tries to make a move on Morbidelli as they go through the fast left-hand kink before they get to turn three. He tries it. He passes him, slides in front of him. Morbidelli can't stop, goes front wheel to back wheel, launches the bike up, and knocks both riders off. In the meantime, everybody is slowed down for turn three. They're turning the corner. Lo and behold, Zarco's bike just ghost rides straight through the gravel trap, pierces the airbag, goes straight through it, and then hits the inside of the curb or a hole or something in the earth there, and then does a super catapult across the track. Morbidelli's bike, excuse me, was down sliding through the gravel. It catches a foot peg or whatever, and then flips up and goes just between Vinales and Rossi, which I guess I got to mention that Rossi had a great start and he was at the front too. The bikes narrowly miss Vinales or Rossi. Vinales at one point had thrown both hands up over his helmet. He had heard a loud explosion, which was Zarco's bike going through the air fence, and threw his arms up in defense for it. Obviously, it was a red flag. There was pretty much nothing left of Zarco's motorcycle. That was a million-plus-dollar Ducati that was essentially trash. Morbidelli's bike was, after having gotten across the track and flipped, decided it was going to disintegrate itself. Carbon fiber swing arms shattered, tires off, flats, everything, you name it. It was pure, unadulterated chaos. It was crazy. And they had to red flag it because, again, we had so much debris, so much stuff on there. The moment for me was the fact that Rossi rides back into the pits at the red flag. He gets there, he pulls in, puts his hands on his helmet like, I'm done. Like, I don't believe this just happened. And goes in and sits down, takes his helmet off. He was in 1,000-yard stare mode. It looked like he had saw dead people, to quote The Sixth Sense. It was frightening. I think Rossi was frightened. Vinales was frightened as well. He just looked horrible. I mean, what did you make of it at just this point, Skyler?
So, I was watching. I had to pause it And I was like, oh, because as soon as the crash went by, I saw the bikes come on the track. I just kind of paused, like, I don't know if we're going to watch this, because I feel like the Ducati might have gone full speed and took out one of the riders. And because at the time when they first cut back, you just saw a bunch of, you know, bikes littered on the track. You're like, whoa, what the hell happened? And I just knew, like, oh, man, please don't tell me someone's on the ground somewhere. Just totally hurt. I don't need another one from one of these races. And it was insane. And when Zarco went through the kink, it looked like, you know, he tried to make the move and he held it full speed. And the momentum that the way that kink is going to go, when the angle that he approached that, it's going to make you drift. And so he started drifting wide with all that power. And unfortunately, Morbidelli was taking a different angle where he's going to start pulling himself back towards the inside. And the two met at full speed on the track and just set off for a grenade. But I watched, especially when you see the onboard and the side shots, I have no idea how Rossi, why, if he either came into the pits and I'm done racing for the rest of my life, I just won my lottery ticket, nobody would blame him. Because yeah, that bike, there wasn't daylight in between. Rossi actually had oil all over his leathers and bike because the bike went by, it was spraying on him as it went through the air. And thankfully, the air fence just stuck out enough to catch that the Ducati of Zarco's there, and it knocked it off balance. It went into the track and dug its, like, it caught, like, the front wing, I think, and that's what dug the fairings in and got it to do the cartwheel for the front wheel and jump over Vinales. Because when they have the shot that you talked about where he's got his hands on his head, the bike is actually above him.
Yes. It's like, scary. Oh, it's God. So... it's so crazy. The whole thing is just amazing.
Yeah. It was almost one of the worst disasters in MotoGP, and it was avoided by millimeters. I still can't believe it.
Yes. I mean, there's so much here in this to unpack. The first thing was Zarco came under some insane amount of criticism for his part in this. You know, Rossi went and had a talking to Zarco, saying that Zarco doesn't respect anybody on the track, and that's the problem nowadays, is that nobody respects anybody on the racetrack. Wow. Okay, that's huge coming from Rossi. But before we dig that any further, do you think if it wasn't Morbidelli that Rossi would have done the same thing?
No. If it was Marquez, he would have wiped out. He'd have been like, oh, that's racing.
I agree. I mean, Rossi... You know, there was people calling Rossi out on it, saying, hey, you do not have the weight and the sway that you once had. Maybe so. But if you look at it, again, and you touched on this, and I just want to try to add a little bit more to it from the racer perspective. Zarco goes into that corner flat chat, into that kink. Now, since he's tighter, he's going to come out wider. That's just how it's going to happen. That's physics. You're not going to stop that from happening. So Morbidelli is out there, and this is one of a couple of things. One, either it was so close Morbidelli had no time to react whatsoever, or Morbidelli was trying to brake, but because he's in the toe of Zarco's bike unexpectedly, he can't adjust in time for it. You know, so I mean, so here's how it goes. Like, I grew up dirt tracking. That's the first thing we did. And you always wanted to become a pro, and you couldn't wait to go out. You wanted to race on a mile because everybody wants to race the mile of dirt. And I remember the first time we got to go out and race the Springfield Mile, we were out there. And so it was a big regional. So it was a bunch of novices like myself, the junior riders, and there were some experts because it was a 600 national. So there was a lot of experts that were riding 600s as well. So they came out, they had a riders meeting specifically for us novices. And I will never forget, Steve Moorhead was brought up on stage. He was, you know, part of the old guard dirt track stars at that time. And he's pretty much put the fear of God into every novice there about the draft and about you don't weave and you don't move around. And you hold your line, and, you know, gave you the whole spiel about what happened, which this is kind of what happens if you have a situation like that. You know, I don't think Zarco intentionally tried to kill Morbidelli, as some people have suggested on Twitter. Okay, Zarco was there. Morbidelli was just in the wrong place at the absolute wrong time, and he couldn't react to it fast enough. You're going 190 miles an hour. You're doing basically half a football field in a second. that there's no time. The human reaction time isn't fast enough. And even if Morbidelli was even slightly on the front brakes, having something now grabbed hold of the slipstream and having no aerodynamic drag whatsoever, or very reduced aerodynamic drag, to try to slow him down, was no way he was going to be able to stop, even if he wanted to. So consequently, we now have those two guys going down. Yeah, that's a bad crash. Well, now we're back to the second part of this problem, and that's the shape of the Red Bull ring. Well, you got a left-handed kink leading into a little straight for a very, very, very slow right-hand turn that turns back on itself. Well, sure enough, here come the bikes, because now they're being ghost-ridden off, and they go straight for everybody else. And if the air fence hadn't been stuck out there a little bit, we would have Vinales with some severe injuries of some kind, because that bike would have T-boned him, and it would have hurt like hell. No question about it. But among all the amazing things of having watched that, if you watch it back again, if you have the ability to, as soon as Zarco's bike kind of explodes the air fence, the corner marshals in that turn are waving every yellow flag and every debris flag they can possibly come up with. I mean, it was like they were Johnny on the spot with the flag. So a tip of the Motopod hat to the corner workers, because at least they were trying to alert everybody to the danger that was now facing everyone going into that corner. And there was a lot of heads up riding by a lot of the guys behind to be able to run wide or to make adjustments to stay out of the debris and not make this any worse than what it was that was going on. And one final thing about Rossi going into that corner. If you watch the onboard again with Rossi going into that corner, I don't know if Rossi had a sixth sense or he saw the shadow that was the bike or exactly what. But Rossi doesn't turn in where he's supposed to. Rossi hesitates for maybe a half of a second and then turns the bike in. That half second saves Rossi from getting Morbidelli's bike slamming him. And Rossi put it the best of anybody. He says, say a prayer to whoever you like because we dodged the big one. And I think we did. And, you know, Matt Oxley has tweeted out just this afternoon that, hey, there's going to be some meeting tomorrow about the very next race. I'm assuming they're going to make some sort of changes to the track or they're going to modify something in some way to, you know, help us not have that problem. I mean, I don't think they're going to cancel the round for this week, but you know, I think they need to make some sort of a change to the track before we go back there next year. I don't know what you think about that, Skylar, but that's my take.
It's a hard track to kind of modify. What will we do with that? Maybe, you know, you extend you bend the straightaway a little bit more and you make it more of a traditional turn, even though it'll be kind of a quick one, it's still, and then straighten out the second half of it perhaps.
Maybe just go straight at the kink and then have like a tighter chicane, but there is some good runoff area over there, but maybe probably not enough, so you might be right about that.
Yeah, I think they were even talking about the wall on the left-hand side as well.
Yeah.
It was dangerous, so there's going to be talks, and it's possible. I know the Red Bull Ring had to do modifications just to get MotoGP back there, and I think at the bare minimum, and Laguna Seca talked about this, that every time Dorna and the FIM showed up to a track, they did a race, they wanted another change, and another change, and another change, and another change. And Red Bull Ring, they may be willing to do it, or they may just like, oh, okay, no, we've got F1, we're good, we'll do everything else, so we'll see you later. It depends. KTM's got a big stake over there, so maybe they won't. And it is the Red Bull Ring, and Red Bull wants to make sure they have a race at home. So will the changes be done? I think they will make a change to it, but it's going to take quite a bit of moving pieces. But let's get back to the restart, because we still got to finish this bad boy.
Oh, that's right. Well, so the other thing is that, you know, when we get back in the pits, Paul Espargaro comes in, right? He was leading, and he's about ready to throw those toys out of the pram because he was basically gone, okay? He took a shit ton of flack for that, too, on Twitter, like, you know, as if he didn't care. Well, you know what? A few minutes later, he sees what happened, and he did make a motion as like, wow, that was pretty crazy. But he still hadn't exactly calmed himself back down. Now, that being said, the reason he might have, you know, I've been in that position, right? So, quick story. I was racing the old-time Newsies, Dayton, Ohio. It's the best-paying regional race there is. I was out front by Country Mile. A couple guys get tangled up, knock out some hay bales. They red flag the race. It's a 3-lap dash for the cash. I wind up breaking the clutch in my bike, spray oil over the rear tire. I finish second, right? I was pissed. Like, I didn't want that race to be stopped. I had this one in the bag. So I understand where Paul is. But, you know, the thing that he didn't do, and he didn't do this in the restart, was he did not calm himself down. Mm-mm. He rode with so many mistakes and so many problems in that restart.
So many.
It was ridiculous. Like, come on. You are a professional. You need to pull your shit together, and you need to go out there and race. Now, Matt Oxley told us that, hey, he didn't have any more of the medium tires left, and that's what he wanted on the bike, so he had to have a soft. Well, that's no – I mean, I get it. That's just shit luck in a situation of what happens, right? But you have to – rise above it. Miller was on softs because he didn't have any other tires.
I was just about to say, if you want to see an example of what to do, all you had to do was look at the guy who finished there near the front of the field and was leading it for a little bit.
Right. And so here it is, you know, where Espargaro runs off the track. He's bumping into everybody. He takes Oliveira down. I mean, that was like unexcusable. He runs wide. Oliveira's online, and Paul just comes in and puts a body on him and knocks them both off. Mm-hmm. And then just struts off into the gravel trap about like how bad things were for him. Wow. I mean, you know what? You got handed the keys to the castle with an HRC contract. Do you think HRC is going to take too kindly to what you just did? Not at all.
Well, considering they're weak, I don't think they'll take anything at this point. Well,
right. But I guess where I was trying to drive the point was HRC is one of the most professional teams that exists in that paddock.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of attitude is not going to go over well there. And
no.
I get it. Paul's kind of miffed because Brad became the first guy to win on a KTM. I understand that. I sense your frustration, Paul. And I sympathize with you for that. But what you did was just not even close to being professional afterwards and after that restart. So, but I mean, after that, basically you had roughly you know, Miller was out front and he had the soft tires on. Dovizioso basically hounded him down for it. But the really interesting thing was the Suzukis, because the Yamahas now were nowhere. Like, I mean, I don't blame Rossi for not having raced as well as he did. Vinales definitely had, from his onboard, he had the fear of turn three, because he definitely backed off early going into that corner after the restart. And I don't blame him. Take me a little bit to overcome that as well. But the big race was really Rins on the Ducatis. And Rins was riding the wheels off the Suzuki. And Suzuki's done a lot of work. They're not that slow. They're only about 1.2 miles an hour slower than the Yamaha, than the Ducatis. The Yamahas were about 2.5 miles an hour slower. I mean, they were slower than their 2016 bikes, but we know Yamaha's got an engine problem, so they probably took some revs out of it, so they weren't going to be fast in a straight line. So they're really able, really good at corner speed. Well, that's what Rins was using, but Rins was having a little problem of his own, because he showed us in that 5-6 area, he was in there really deep, and he actually wound up tucking the front one time and saved it. And then once he kind of got by Dovizioso, the Ducati kind of powered back in front of him again. And then he winds up crashing. Was Rins in the lead when he crashed it out, or was he second? I don't
remember. He had just taken the lead, literally. He had made the pass for the lead, went through front tire, little chatter, little gone, and zoof, away he goes.
Away he goes. So Rins is down. Now, could Rins have saved it if his right shoulder was completely healed? Maybe, maybe not. That's conjecture. But Rins goes into the gravel trap. That left just Dovizioso, Miller, and Mir to race to the victory. And honestly, Mir tried everything that he could, right? I mean, he was all over the back of Miller. He was battling, of course, the Ducati horsepower thing. But Mir was making it up on the brakes. He was making it up in that 5, 6, 7, 8 section of the track, which is the only time part of the track that's really flowy to begin with. But as the race unfolded, Dovizioso kind of in a cakewalk. He won by about a second and a half. But Mir did get Miller at the end. He sucked him into, he sucked Miller into going deeper into the, to riding defensively and not having enough grip on the front to hold the corner and hold the line. So he ran wide at 9, allowing Mir to get under at 10. And then he was able to squirt to the line before the horsepower of the Ducati pulled Miller back in again. So Mir finally gets that long-awaited podium for MotoGP by finishing second. Miller was then third. Binder had a great race coming from where he was, and he took fourth. So I think he represented himself well on KTM. Well, they won last weekend. They were fourth this weekend. I don't think that's too bad of a showing.
Nope.
Rossi
nope.
was
and it brings him up and it brings him up into the championship fight too.
Yeah, you know, Binder is a championship contender. You know, mm-hmm. I think he's got a possibility of finishing very well in the championship. Is he going to win the championship? Probably not. But man, he's definitely got a shot, and that's mm-hmm. all anybody ever wants is just a shot. Rossi was the best Yamaha in fifth, and then, you know, Nakagami was sixth, then Petrucci was seventh, Quartararo fell all the way back to eighth. You know, he had overheating brakes and the Yamaha engine being turned down. You know, he got lucky. He could have been a lot worse in the points than what it was if it hadn't been red flagged. So maybe Quartararo gets a little race luck there, and his championship lead is only cut by 11 points as opposed to being probably cut to, you know, 5 points or whatever. Then Lecuona, Vinales finished 10th, and then Espargaró was there in 11th, then Pirro, Smith, Alex Marquez, and then Crutchlow, Rabat, and Brodel. And that winds up, and again, as you said, HRC Honda's having a terrible race with both the guys near the back, and, you know, they're almost 30 seconds off the pace of the guys up front. That's not where the Hondas should be, but that's just where we are. So that's the race. Anything else, Skyler? Did I miss anything in the end here you want to talk about?
No, actually, you did a really good job covering a lot of the notes. Like the whole thing, I wanted to make a big stink about how Pole was overriding the bike and going wide and blowing corners. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, spot on, perfect. Like, you covered that right where I was at. The Yamaha is definitely, you know, while they have the one-lap pace there, they definitely do not have race pace. And Vinales even said, or not Vinales, Quartararo said after the race, like you said, he was getting a lot of brake fade throughout the race and definitely was hampering him throughout. But yeah, that brings us to the championship there, Jim.
Yes, the championship standings. So Quartararo is now only 11 points ahead of Dovizioso, who's second. Again, I remind you, Dovizioso can be world champion and not have a ride next year.
Mm-hmm.
just think about that one for a minute, because that is wild. Vinales is third. Binder has now vaulted himself to fourth, and he's only 25. He's a race win away from it. And if you don't think the KTMs don't have a shot at winning another race this year, I think they do. They, you know, they have the front end figured out. In the V4 configuration, they have a sweet front end. And what's interesting is that, you know, Espargaró is going to go to HRC. So, you know, whatever weird magic the Austrians have figured out on that front end, be it suspension, geometry, whatever, Pol's going to take with him, and HRC will soon have. So there's another scary thought. Marquez on a bike with a front end that might actually half-ass work. So yeah, think about that one.
That would be scary.
It would be very scary. He might run the table. If that's the case, he might run the table.
Right.
So Rossi was fifth, Nakagami, then Miller, Morbidelli, Mir, and now Zarco rounds out your top 10. So that is the race results from the first race in Austria. The Styrian Grand Prix is next weekend. And who knows? We may or may not be having that one. Odds are, I think it's going to be raced. Not sure what they're going to say, but I think we all need to stay tuned to see what comes out of the meeting tomorrow, because we just don't know yet.
Yeah, and like you said, I'm sure it's going to happen. They're going to figure it out. It's going to be hard pressed to say that the Ducatis again will be a threat. They've got a perfect record since MotoGP has gone back to the Austrian. And the KTMs definitely can run with them. Now that Brad's kind of figured it out, he may be stronger in qualifying this time, be more towards the front. Pol will be looking for revenge. Dovizioso will be going out there looking to stick it to Ducati any chance he gets at this point. And maybe Petrucci gets up there. You never know. Of course, Miller will be up there as a threat. And if he gets some tires that he can last him the whole race, he'll be good. So it's going to be another good race this weekend for sure. And then even after watching, if we get another one here, it's like, okay, cool. After this, I need another break from GP. As much as I've missed racing, this stuff was so intense. Like, it's like, whew. All right, let's get a weekend reset. Then we'll come back and watch some more.
Yep. So there's one other little weird thing in all of this, and Matt Oxley pointed this out in his articles from the race weekend. We are at round five of a 14-round championship, leaving us 9 rounds to be completed. We know that Marquez is not going to race again until Misano. So that gives Marquez 8 races. He will probably only be maybe 80 to 90 points down in the championship. Can he come back? Can he come back and win a title? Anything's possible. I highly doubt it. That's a mountain to overcome that I don't think's even really possible.
It'll have to go. There'd be more than just him being the deciding factor.
Oh, yeah.
It'll have to be kind of like how Nikki Hayden's championship was almost erased because he had like a 59-point lead, and then Rossi just ran that down, being that Rossi started winning the races and Hayden's bike started having technical issues and everything else towards the end. So it would take something like that for these guys to either start knocking each other off and Marquez, you know, getting first. But I don't think we're gonna see the ultimate comeback. And if it did, I think you'd have to put an asterisk that it was the ultimate comeback because somebody else just shit the bed.
Right. I guess what's really interesting to me is think about throwing the cat among the pigeons. I mean, you put Marquez inside of this anywhere, and you know, riding with the Red Mist, he's going to probably be damn good. So these other guys are basically going to pretty much step back if they have any sense at all and say, look, he's not a championship threat. So, where is my main competitor? If Quartararo is running second to Marquez, or let's say he's running third to Marquez, and Espargaró is winning a race, is Quartararo really going to try to get past Marquez? He shouldn't.
No way.
Right?
No.
He shouldn't try. But boy, that's going to throw some weird dynamic into this championship at the end. That's what I'm thinking is going to happen. There's just going to be another layer of weird chaos that's going to happen here as this championship comes to a close. But we shall wait and see what happens.
Speaking of close, I think it's about time for us to wrap it up here. We are into overtime for what we like to do, and so let's wrap it up. Remember, folks, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. That goes to all of the hosts. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook. We're on facebook.com/motopod. That's the Motopod fan page. We're on Twitter. We're @moto_pod. You can follow Sarah for any news and general motorcycle banter. I can be found on Twitter and Instagram @SkylarV28. Jim, where can people find you?
Instagram and Twitter @MotoRGV.
Right on. So, all right, so just a few days' time, we'll be back at the Styrian Grand Prix, which, of course, is just the same track, different name. But will there be a difference? Will there be a change in track layout? We don't know. Stay tuned, and we will catch you all next week. Zoom, zoom.